Okay, well, welcome, everyone, to the first of an ongoing series entitled We Are Many, Inquiries into Chicago Activism, which sets to explore the connections between different groups in Chicago and celebrate the successes, but also start a conversation about some of the obstacles that we may have encounter in organizing in all different fashions and all different groups. And tonight, we will be... Oh, and if you want to check out more information on that, go to www.myspace.com/NWRC for more information on the We Are Many series as a whole, which is held every second Thursday at 7 p.m. at the New World Resource Center, 1300 Northwestern Avenue, Western and Potomac. But specifically tonight, we have Chicago Media Action, and specifically Mitchell Shtepanchik.
That'll work.
Okay. And Scott Sanders. And for more information about Chicago Media Action, go to www.ChicagoMediaAction.org. Specifically, Mitchell Shtepanchik is a contributor to assorted media projects in print, web, radio, and television, and is a longtime organizer in the politics of media. And Scott Sanders has worked as an independent documentary filmmaker and librarian. He has worked to reform media, and particularly public and community media. So the format that we really have for this whole thing is that Chicago Media Action, CMA, will be just talking about what their organization does, the successes that they've had, the obstacles, and what it means in a broader sense for Chicago and for the nation and internationally as a whole, and then open it up for discussion afterwards. So with no further interruption, Mitchell and Scott.
Thank you. The talk that we'll probably give to start out the event will basically divide it more or less into four parts, although I should actually preface it to just explain a little bit more about what Chicago Media Action is. And there's a very brief blurb here that I'll read aloud. What is Chicago Media Action? Chicago Media Action, CMA, is a Chicago-based group dedicated to media issues in Chicago and the Chicago area. CMA works to broaden and improve Chicago's mainstream media, and to build Chicago's independent media. CMA has worked on many media-themed issues, including FCC-led media concentration, public television, radio policy, cable TV access, independent media support, network neutrality, and internet policy issues, as well as direct challenges to the corporate media. Our specific actions have included popular lobbying efforts, protests, formal media studies, legal challenges, presentations on media to media outlets and to groups large and small, and our own series of public forums, among other actions. The presentation that we'll give this evening is more or less divided into four parts. First part, Scott will give a presentation of the kinds of current actions that CMA is involved with. Then the second part is me giving a presentation about past actions that CMA has done and past successes. Actually, I may make that the third part, and I make the second part instead a presentation on some of the obstacles that we faced. So it basically would be what we're doing now, some of the obstacles that we faced. I'll talk about that as well, some of the successes that CMA has had, and then the fourth and final part Scott will also give on basically where do we go from here, what has yet to be done, and the future, more or less. So that's how we'll outline the talk, and Scott, if you would begin.
All right. I think the first thing I'll talk about is some local actions that we're involved in right now or that we've been involved in very recently. And then I'll just touch on several actions that we're also involved in that are more of a national basis. First off, one of the biggest pluses that we've got under our belt so far is the we've been trying to assist the low power FM movement. These are small radio stations. There's been a fight for a number of years just in trying to get the space opened up for these stations, and the people fighting against it have been, maybe not too surprisingly, one of the major people groups fighting against it is a stronger non-commercial radio channels. I think the FCC at first wasn't very happy about these frequencies either, but now apparently we're right on the brink of having some spaces open up, even in urban areas. These are for rather low wattage stations. I believe it's under 100 watts, basically. So they have a reach of maybe a couple miles, but these are very community-oriented stations, and the people that tend to run them and sustain them are some of the most committed people, and our hats are off to people who are trying to do that. One group that's trying to right now get involved in that is called CHIRP. Do you remember what that stands for?
The Chicago Independent Radio Project.
Chicago Independent Radio Project. And that's a lot of the people involved in that are working out of Loyola University and its radio station. And we will do anything that we can to support them in their efforts. Another area that we've been working in recently, that there was a full power window that opened up this past October for also for non-commercial radio stations. And actually in the Chicago area, there were several possible places that simply didn't really have a radio station locally providing them with nonprofit information, collectively run. And we repeatedly put the word out for that. And I was just checking on the FCC's website, and there actually were four groups or persons in the state of Illinois that looks like the door is clear and open for them to they were unchallenged. In other words, they didn't ask for a frequency from the FCC that another group was asking for. So there's at least four right there, one I believe in Glen Ellyn. So people in Glen Ellyn may be getting a radio station, but this could be taking maybe, it varies greatly, but it could be within a year and a half or two maybe. A number of other frequencies are in the process of being sorted through and allotted by the FCC right as we speak. Interesting local issue that's come up, this was actually in the Chicago Reader just this past weekend. There's a bit of a controversy with a film by the title of Turning the Corner, and we're tracking that issue. This is a film involving, and I believe shot by, girls who had in the past been involved in one way or another in prostitution and had evolved beyond that and decided to make a film about this. And it won an award that was, I believe the award was from the Chicago Reporter. And the deal, according to Michael Miner's Reader column, Hot Type, which we read religiously, among many, many other sources like that, according to Miner, the deal was that the winner of the contest would be broadcast on Image Union, which is the short format independent film feature program that's been on WTTW, Chicago's public TV station now for, since about 1980 or so, I believe. They didn't want to, they had sensitivity problems with it. I think the word was sensitivities came up. And so we're sort of injecting ourselves into the middle of that little issue. And hopefully everyone will resolve and be friends, and things will be aired, and filmmakers and TV stations will both be happy. So that's the goal, at least. Probably the most important local issue that we're dealing with at Chicago Media Action right now is the situation which locally, in terms of the Chicago Tribune and the waivers that it has just received from the Federal Communications Commission also plays into a much larger and even scarier national issue with the collapse of the cross-ownership rules nationally. These essentially what cross-ownership means, it's another form of media ownership concentration. Cross-ownership in this case is a cross-ownership between a broadcast TV outlet and a daily newspaper. And the problem is that this really must be two separate and distinct voices, independent from each other. And the Chicago Tribune would like to just have one big loud voice. And maybe that might be the only voice all of us could hear someday if we're not careful. And these cross-ownership rules were put into place in the mid-70s in order to prevent something like that from happening and prevent the creation of a monomedia a la George Orwell. So in order to avoid that, Chicago Media Action has tried to promote this issue, explain it to people, educate people on the fact that they don't want the Tribune to own five cross-ownership situations across the country and in several cities. They just historically have been given these waivers. Just, it's okay, someday you'll have to sell those TV stations, but not yet. Just relax and make lots of money and take over too much media and be a pig, basically, about things. Now the Tribune being sold to Sam Zell, and the cross-ownership rules do not apply when the Tribune is sold. These are grandfathered rules, but if the corporation is to be sold as it is now, then we've got a whole new ball game. The FCC decided to give them permanent waivers for WGN AM and WGN TV, which is essentially unprecedented. They gave them, we'll call them temporary waivers, for the other four situations where they have newspaper broadcast cross-ownership. This is making the activist community furious, it's making Chicagoans furious, and it plays into the next step of this FCC's game, which is to relax the cross-ownership of rules nationally. And on the, well, as we tape, this date may have already passed by the time some people see this, but the 18th of December, that is apparently the date when the FCC is going to announce its newest assault on our democracy. So that's that in a nutshell, and we'll probably be coming back to that issue because it's very hot and it's very important and involves really a lot of the essence of what Chicago Media Action is all about. I'll just touch on the other issues and then hand it over to Mitchell. Currently, at least, we work on lots of issues, so this is just a partial list of what we're working on lately. We have on our website there's still an action that you can take part in. I monitored the PBS series Frontline. They did an episode about Iran, basically they were claiming that explosively formed penetrators, sort of like a mortar, it's a shaped charge that cuts right through a foot of steel. And kills whoever happens to be inside that vehicle. They were claiming that these were all made in Iran, and they just simply had no proof. And this is sort of typical of Frontline when it comes down to these crucial issues involving potential wars and such types of things. This is just something that you have to can't trust and that you have to monitor. And so we ask people to email the president of PBS and explain to her that the community should be running public media and that PBS should not be propagandizing for the government. Also, we work on net neutrality. We had an action that we were passing through Chicago Media Action involving that concerning censored text messages by NARAL. You may have heard of that issue. This is just a couple months ago. We also passed through an action from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Some of our best friends are at FAIR, I've known them for years. And they had a particular action where NPR, in one of their stories, passed the information that was gained through torture as if it was fact, and not the complete baloney that virtually anything you could ever gain from torturing somebody to get your, quote, information, unquote. So that was particularly annoying, because that's supposed to be public radio. And we also were asking people to get the FCC to create what's called a minority task force, which is to much better detail, document, and research, and look for solutions for the huge problem of lack of minority ownership of especially of broadcast media. This was a huge issue, especially it came to the fore at the FCC's hearing that occurred here in Chicago at Operation Push headquarters on September 20th. It was attended by about 800 people. And believe me, there were a large number of people there extremely concerned and very frustrated with this FCC that doesn't seem to listen to public comment. They went around the country and got all this public comment, and they're about to just ignore it. So that's it in a nutshell, I guess, of what we're doing now and lately. And I'll give it to Mitchell, and then I'll be back.
Thank you, Scott. So Scott has outlined some of the things, and we'll probably be touching on some of those topics and other topics in the course of this presentation of what CMA is doing and has done. Probably the authoritative resource to find out about what CMA is up to and has done is our website, chicagomediaaction.org. Nonetheless, we've made our bailiwick over the last 5 years the media and organizing around the media. And that presents its own set of obstacles, probably unique among any kind of political organizing that I think you can think of. I'll just outline, I think, three major obstacles that I think CMA has faced in its more than 5 years of work that it's been doing. One is the fact that the media are in a unique position where they're able to dictate the terms of awareness of their own politics. Basically, the idea being that it's like the old joke, who's going to tell you, the media? The idea being that the media don't have to talk about their own politics because they're the media, and for a good reason. It turns out that their politics are hugely corrupt, and they wield a tremendous amount of influence, certainly on Capitol Hill, for example, or in Springfield, where politicians are very loath to antagonize major media interests for the very virtue of the fact that they are able to dictate the terms of a lot of public awareness on a lot of issues, including on other issues. And so that poses maybe the single most difficult obstacle that we face. Of how you actually talk about the media without using the media. By its very nature, the media are not going to talk about their own politics. And so that's a lot of what I think CMA has done over the years. But that's the big one, is that the media simply don't talk about these issues. And as a result, that's made it very, very hard to work around these issues, because people will look to the media to learn about these issues. But when we talk about them, people say, well, I've never heard of that before, and the media never talks about it. Well, good reason. But it's not a conspiracy. It's, as Mark Crispin Miller would say, it's not a conspiracy, it's business as usual. The media themselves are not shy about talking about these issues. If you read, like, say, the trade press of the media business community, publications like Broadcasting and Cable or Editor and Publisher, which are directed to an audience of mostly investors and media producers and media owners, they're not shy about this. But they're reaching a very select audience. They don't ever talk about these things as far as matter of public concern, and for good reason. It turns out that, as public opinion surveys have documented in the last few years, the more people know about the issues regarding the politics of the media, the more they're able to get outraged over that fact, and the more they're able to get involved on that issue. And we'll talk more about that in a bit. Second obstacle that we faced has been over the issue of money and resources, that not only are the media in that singularly unique position, but also they rank among some of the most powerful corporations and well-funded entities certainly in the United States, and probably ranking among the world. You can probably find among the top 50 corporations, a number of them probably in the vicinity of about 20%. I don't know the exact number, but that would be an interesting research question for someone. That rank among the top 20 corporations or the Fortune 500 of our media companies. And as a result, they wield tremendous resources, even if people knew more about the issue. Nonetheless, this playing field otherwise is very skewed in the fact that most media outlets wield a tremendous amount of money to which they can deploy in terms of lawyers, lobbyists, influence elsewhere, and certainly in with regards to commercial time, where you will, for example, watch NBC and see a commercial for Comcast. A tremendous amount of influence there of this kind of almost an incestuous relationship. So the money and resources factor, which is very considerable, even if you take the knowledge factor. And the third obstacle that we found, or at least that I found certainly, and probably others as well, is the fact that the issue of the media is really hard for a lot of people to understand, and it's really hard to compress into a very quick soundbite issue. It's abstract, it's hard to understand, it changes a lot. You've got to keep track of at least a half dozen academic fields of something like economics, history, politics, jurisprudence, technology, the media itself. And they're all changing all the time. And they can all interact with and one another in various different ways. And then suddenly you're asking to present that to people. Well, understandably, a lot of people are going to have to ask questions about that. And suddenly it's a real challenge to have to give presentations about that, where suddenly you're now, instead of giving a presentation on one thing, you're giving a presentation on six different things all at once. But understandably, that's been a big challenge of getting people to, I think this has changed some, but to understand not only all the various issues, but also the various factors that can play into that issue. And that's been a singularly big challenge of this, where I'll talk with fellow political activists, very savvy people, who will nonetheless look at the issue regarding the politics of media in the United States, and they'll just be utterly daunted. And understandably so. It is daunting. Never mind for political activists, but for average Joe Chicagoan walking down the street who suddenly asked about media concentration, and usually you'd be lucky if they give you anything besides a blank stare. That's changed, though. And I think the fact that that's changed in recent years is one of the successes, and I'll mention this as my segue to the various successes that CMA has had. About if we had this talk maybe 5 years ago, say November 2002, it was a very different set of circumstances than now in December 2007 of this matter where a lot of people now know about these issues. And that alone has changed the tenor of the debate, and the fact that I don't have to give a half-hour lecture anytime I want to talk about media concentration, let's say. I can just give a very brief description of it and point to key examples, and people get it, and they get it fairly quickly, and more people are getting it, and they are also getting involved on that. And that's been, I think, the biggest key tactic that we've been using at CMA to get involved on these issues. And what issues have we used this tactic and other related efforts to bring some success? I'll mention a number of key examples. One is, and it might be the biggest one of all in my mind, the Federal Communications Commission and their implementation of rules to increase media concentration in Chicago and nationwide, where 5 years ago you'd be hard-pressed to get anyone who understood the importance or the gravity of the issue. It has, within a year of us taking the issue on, upwards of 3 million people had chimed into the Federal Communications Commission and to Congress, which wound up fueling an emergency court order and lawsuit, which wound up reversing the FCC action in its entirety. And that's just one example where this can make a difference, and a big difference. Another issue is that of, well, just right here in Illinois, the Illinois Telecommunications Act, the rewrite of the state law regarding media and internet in Illinois was up for a rewrite this year. The big factor here was regarding what are termed state video franchises, the idea that phone companies want to basically introduce their version of cable television. The technologies are improving such that you can now distribute television not just via cable lines, but now increasingly through telephone lines. So that means that a company like AT&T could introduce their version of cable television to consumers in the state of Illinois, or nationwide for that matter. The thing, though, is that they want to change the rules in their favor so that they don't have to provide current preferential treatment to things like public access television channels, community media centers, and any other kinds of public interest obligations for which current incumbent cable providers have provided since 1984 when the Cable Act was passed in the United States. There was a pretty serious fight over that here in Illinois, as there have been fights in state-by-state battles in legislatures across the country. Here we were able to win a pretty interesting compromise, where ostensibly the phone companies got what they wanted in terms of their pushing to have a state video franchise, but they didn't get what they also wanted regarding the evisceration of public interest obligations. We were able to maintain that and win that for what they had want for should AT&T become a leading cable provider in Illinois. Suddenly they now have to answer to this, and so suddenly they got their balloon, but it's kind of deflated, to use one way of describing it. That was one pretty serious victory. Scott had mentioned the matter regarding network neutrality, the idea of internet service providers like phone and cable companies both, who are the major providers of internet access in Chicago and nationwide, basically want to allow for discrimination of content, where they basically, instead of you going to my website, let's say, and you have to obviously pay a fee, but nobody says you can't do that. You just pay your access fees, and you go on the internet, and you go to whatever access is provided. And same thing with me as a provider. I can go on the internet and go on anywhere that I want. I can put on anything I want. Of course, I've got to obey laws and such. But if I wanted to put a website that said, I don't know, screwAT&T.com or something like that, where it's basically the most anti-AT&T website, AT&T wouldn't be allowed to say, no, you can't put that up. But in early 2006, in the rewrite of the federal law, the Telecommunications Act, where this was a pretty serious issue, and where we actually have another serious local connection, a very dismal rewrite of the law had as its first Democratic co-sponsor, First District of Illinois Representative Bobby Rush.
Oops.
A guy who is as progressive as they come in the Congress was the first Democratic co-sponsor and probably the leading Democratic Party advocate of this tremendously dismal bill that would have just utterly decimated the principles of a relatively free and open internet, probably in perpetuity. And he was basically leading the charge on this count.
Well, there was one thing in it for his community, of course, which was the selling point of the deal was a free computer lab. So,
which AT&T ponied up more than $1 billion to pay, we might add. This was actually a front page story in the Chicago Sun-Times, which actually broke this fact. Nonetheless, it was exceedingly hard because the phone and cable companies did not want this to become an issue. And they held tremendous sway over other media because not only are they major media concerns in their own right, but also major advertising concerns. And so other major media outlets didn't want to rock that boat over that fact. So what did we do? Well, we made it an issue. We told everyone we can think of. We had written articles. We had organized events, including an event here in Chicago, which was coordinated with a series of events in at least a half dozen other cities nationwide on what was termed the National Day of Outrage, where we basically wanted to make sure at the very least that a dismal law regarding the internet wouldn't get passed. And that worked too. It turns out that that actually led to series of momentum, and we can talk about this further, where that dismal rewrite, which usually sails through, got blocked, got defeated, and lost. That's not to say that the issue isn't over with by any means, but nonetheless, we were able to win this pretty significant victory and take part in efforts nationwide that helped in this count. Scott had also mentioned WTTW, the main PBS affiliate in Chicago. Chicago Media Action had spent more than a year in researching and convening probably the leading study of that station that has ever been done. We looked at more than 6 weeks of content of their flagship show, Chicago Tonight, basically looking at an analysis of the breakdown of guests on the show, more than 400 over the course of a six-week study that we had analyzed in late 2003 and early 2004. Analyzed the results, figured out the findings, wrote them up and presented it on our website and in other forum, and basically have used this as a kind of not only a rallying cry for other groups to do likewise work, but also as a disciplining stick for what's ostensibly a public television station that, as our study has shown, and you can go to the website at chicagomediaaction.org to find out, it wasn't a terribly well... the station doesn't do a terribly good job as far as representing the public or Chicago general on this count. And we can talk about that further.
But I could just interject just for a moment, because the nature of that success, that you could consider that one of CMA's biggest successes, because the top three news employees were out the door.
Within
these
about
were
3 months.
Former Fox employees in the news department were all gone, and you can see that our study came out. We got a lot of press attention to that study. We learned that if you are very careful with your facts and accurate and academic even in your presentation, that even the mainstream media has to pay at least a degree of attention to what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And and in fact also that was also about the same time that somehow Carol Marine ended up starting to work at Channel 11 also as part of her job.
Local journalist Carol Marine.
It was definitely, there were some victories involved with that set of actions.
Right. And there's also independent media work that CMA has done. Probably key among them has been the hour-long daily radio and TV news show Democracy Now! One of our members, Dale Lehman, who works at WZRD Radio, it turns out was instrumental in getting Democracy Now! On WZRD to the point where he would wake up every morning at about 5 in the morning to make sure that he got the radio station to be there at 7 a.m. local time to make sure that the show aired on WZRD every weekday morning. And he had done this for months. And that got the ball rolling and wound up getting a tremendous boost of publicity, not only for the show, but also for the station. And three other radio stations in subsequent years would basically follow WZRD's lead in that regard.
And CAN-TV.
And CAN-TV, Chicago Access Network Television, airs in 500,000 Chicago-area public cable households in Chicago, in the city of Chicago limits. Democracy Now!, every morning, Channel 19, 7 a.m. CMA has played a role in that because it turns out that Chicago Media Action is the local organizational nonprofit sponsor of Democracy Now! On CAN-TV. The reason it can air in Chicago is because we serve as the local organizational nonprofit sponsor of the show. We even filled out a bunch of paperwork and submitted forms to verify that fact with the station and with Democracy Now! And so every morning, I can't tell you how many people have come up to me and say, that's the best thing you've ever done with getting that show on CAN-TV. Of course, a lot of people also helped, but we played that key role there in that regard. And I'll end on this success, although we could probably go on for much of the evening and we'll talk further about this, but maybe another big success as far as certainly getting media coverage of the of this, even if it hasn't yet shaped yet the content of what people see. Formal license challenges. All over the air television and radio stations in the United States have to be licensed by the Federal Communications Commission. When those licenses expire after a given period of time, currently the law sets it at 8 years, but when that expiration happens and a renewal could take place, various actions can then be taken with the agency regarding one or more stations. And in the case of Chicago, Chicago Media Action had filed the strongest action you can take, what's termed a petition to deny, against 9 Chicago area TV stations. 8 in Illinois and 1 in Indiana, which actually happens to have its broadcast footprint within Chicago. But they were all challenged more broadly for not serving the public interest, which all TV stations and radio stations in the United States that have licenses are ostensibly forced to do. Although, as we've seen, that's very, very poorly enforced, to the point of almost never. But the point being that challenge... where we're challenging these stations, it ranks as probably the most significant challenge maybe in a generation that we've seen on this count. So much so that even the major media themselves took some notice, mostly in print, some in radio. I don't think at all on television, but nonetheless, that was seriously significant. The specific charge at issue was regarding coverage of local electoral politics, where the accusation was, based on formal studies that have actually been conducted of a number of cities across the United States, was that local media simply don't cover local politics or local electoral issues. In the 2004 campaign, I think the study was something of 3% of all news airtime was devoted to anything having to do with local electoral issues. Most of the electoral campaign tended to be, at least in the case of Illinois, the presidential race between Bush and Kerry and the senatorial race between Barack Obama and Alan Keyes. Most of the bulk of the coverage tended to be along those issues. Almost nothing with regards to local political issues.
Sure.
And so that was one thing that we had basically fought on as a challenge. It took about more than a year and a half, but the FCC had actually submitted a rejection of the petition. Within a month, we actually submitted an appeal. That appeal is still forthcoming, and we're still waiting on a response back. It could be any day now. We were expecting, it was filed back in July, and we were told 5 or 6 months by our legal counsel, the Media Access Project, the Washington, D.C. law firm that works on media issues. They served as our attorneys on this count. And nonetheless, the action is unprecedented, especially with where it could go. All signs seem to be that the FCC will probably reject this appeal. Then it will be an appeal which, as far as I know, has probably never been done to the FCC itself, where we're actually probably going to testify in Washington before all 5 sitting FCC commissioners to make our case. Where it goes from there, who knows? It's never been done before. But a lot of what we've done and a lot of these successes have never been done before. But it's like the saying about these things, don't try to predict the future, try to shape things to make them happen. So that's a little overview of some of the successes that CMA has had. And to wrap up this presentation, Scott will give us a little bit of a view in the crystal ball, what has yet to be done and where we may go from here.
Yes. You start to add all these things up, and I think what we're attempting to do is sort of to make Chicago a sort of an axis around which progressive media change might occur, and it being in the center of the country is sort of interesting visually on that. But there really has been a large concentration of activism, just as there's concentration of media ownership throughout the nation. I think we've got a very good concentration of active people in this town that are very concerned about their media system, both corporate media, trying to improve and restructure it, and going into the future, trying to address problems with the public media structure as well. And looking into that crystal ball, rather not with a blank stare, but with a hopeful look, I had to sit down and come up with a list of our wish list, what we hope we can all organize together around to try to help and fix and improve. And these are ongoing battles, many of them. They go in stages. You don't just kind of work on it for a week and get a result that you can show your folks or something. It takes time. All this has taken a lot of time. But I know one thing that we've thought about many, many times for some time is what would in essence be a breakup of the Chicago Tribune Company. And this could be accomplished essentially just by denying these waivers that they were just given. We feel that the waivers that they were given will not stand up in court, and there will be a series of legal actions ensuing.
If I could just interrupt briefly,
yes.
There is an action already underway
mm-hmm.
against the Tribune on these potential waivers at the FCC, which the FCC may well reject, but that could open the door to a lot of very interesting legal actions to come.
Yes. And with the FCC's announcement coming on the 18th of December, I foresee even more activities in this regard.
Mm-hmm.
But and that again, that puts Chicago in the center of one of the key fights involving media reform in the United States. And so you're in the hotbed, folks. This is the right place to be if this is a set of issues that you're interested in or interested in working on. Another thing that we look forward to, that this might be a bit more of a longer term thing, but we would eventually like to see publicly elected stationed boards of directors at, one of our associates, Karen Bond, suggested all broadcast media outlets should have elected boards, but we haven't discussed that in much detail. That's sort of a new proposal, but we've been talking about, a lot of us in many parts of the country have been talking about trying to get a system whereby all the public media boards are elected. And I think maybe moving into the future, technology-wise, there may be we may have to look at other forms of democratic control of other types of local media. This is an evolving area. Another important thing that we need to work out that people, citizens, are still trying to work with is Wi-Fi and broadband policy. This is very important because you must have, I happen to live in Skokie. We have what's called a cable duopoly there. We have two cable companies. I called up the city of Skokie and I said, so what's the price difference? And they said, about 5 cents, I think. So, you know, that's competition, but you really have to have what's called a third wire, a third method of receiving the information. And so that will maybe through some mixture of Wi-Fi and broadband, but we're not done with that. We also want to get internet neutrality codified. It's not in the law books yet, and it must be in order to ensure our freedoms for using the internet as an open and democratic tool. We don't want it to turn into just another form of cable TV where someone is making choices for you and those choices are limited. We also would like to, Mitchell mentioned earlier, we had this state telecom law that was, you know, a qualified success, a compromise. Well, what we didn't get yet, which what we must have eventually and hopefully soon, is we want to give the although the consumer protections were put in and the public access was protected, we want the control over those things put back into the communities, because that's logically where you should be dealing with local complaints and local zoning issues and local problems and local build-outs and the purchase of more and new equipment for the local station. These are local issues. They shouldn't be done out of some office in a basement in Springfield, which is apparently what part of this is being done now. As I mentioned, the low-power FM is about to be passed in Congress. It's amazing. It's about the only proactive public media-oriented thing that will have come out of the entire Bush administration period. But it's something. We're getting some tools that can be used by communities and by people who don't normally have enough access to means of communication of this sort. We also are very much interested in working on improving local minority media ownership. Chicago is an extremely diverse city and metropolitan area, and it's very sad when you look at the statistics on the number of women owners and minority owners of the major broadcast outlets and even the other major media outlets. It's just a very stilted and corrupted system that has to be fixed. We're waiting for our FCC complaint to finally finish itself involving the station license petitions to deny. And also, let's see. We recently here in Chicago, we lost an alternative press distributor. So we would like to see that situation remedied. Maybe there'll be some way of getting funding or some new way of organizing that and correcting that problem before any other magazines fail, any zines. We also are looking forward to the digital television transition that happens at the beginning of 2009. Anywhere from $10 to $30 billion worth of spectrum is involved. These are the old analog channels that have to be returned to us because they are ours. They were ours to begin with. We lent them to the broadcasters that have been using them. And it would be quite fitting in a lot of people's mind certainly, to convert that value into some form of permanent and independent, collectively run public media system of some sort, which that's what we've been missing. When our old friend Newton Minow started PBS, it was one of the biggest unfinished jobs ever started in the last century. It was a good idea, not fleshed out, not funded properly, and most importantly, never structured properly. And the result is a faltering democracy, as we've come to learn. Was a major contributor to some of the calamities that have befallen us over recent years. That's a list of things that we look forward to. It's incomplete. I'm sure some of you may have some ideas. And we encourage you to get in touch with us or get in touch with your elected representatives and communicate your needs in these areas of media and communication. If you don't speak up, no one's going to know what you want. If you just sit there, someone's going to take stuff from you if you're not careful. If you don't use it, you're going to lose it, and all those kind of good things.
To follow up on the digital television matter, Scott very correctly mentioned that there's a tremendous potential for good. I kind of take a very dismal look on it, seeing as there's a tremendous potential for harm as well. I actually just finished an essay which was published in the journal out of the University of Texas called Flow TV. It's an essay I entitled The Forthcoming DTV Tsunami, basically to outline that at least in the city of Chicago, probably about, according to the most recent numbers I've seen, about 21% of all Chicagoans, about a fifth of the city, still use over-the-air analog television, for which when that digital television conversion happens on February 18, 2009, are they going to know? If they know, how are they going to get television access? They may be able to get what are provided as a converter box to convert the forthcoming digital signals into an analog equivalent so that analog TVs still work. If they get them, how will they be able to pay for them? I mean, if they're not able to afford a digital TV set or cable or satellite, what's the likelihood that they can actually afford a converter box? How will they know? And what about provisions regarding people who don't have technical skills or aren't near any major retailers, especially a lot of rural communities? Or for communities, and this was very informal complaint was lodged about this, deaf and hard of hearing communities have expressed pretty serious concerns regarding closed captioning basically failing across the board regarding DTV. What's to happen with that? What provisions are being made for that? My fear is that conversion or a fiasco or maybe a series of unfolding fiascos that could happen in the wake of this DTV conversion in just under a year and a half could just be the beginning of maybe a disaster of pretty serious media proportions. If there's any good thing to be said about that is that it would dramatically increase the awareness of some of the issues we've been talking about. Back 5 years ago and 4 years ago when the FCC had opened their docket regarding media ownership, an unprecedented torrent of comment had flown in from across the political spectrum. When the dust settled, more than 3 million people had commented, where maybe in the FCC's entire 70-plus year history, yeah, it was maybe 5,000 comments. Now suddenly it's 3 million comments, and a lot of people know about the issue and aren't going to let it go very easily. Multiply that by 10 or 20, Because if you expand it beyond just the city of Chicago, but maybe nationwide, estimates of upwards of 50 million people could be affected by this. Suddenly, they're going to be entering the fray. And those are numbers that are not going to be easily or readily ignored. And the potential there is hopeful for something positive. You were going to say something, Scott?
I was going to say that to emphasize that the particular groups that would be most negatively affected by this possible tsunami tend to be lower income groups, less educated groups, mm-hmm. and older groups.
Another study was actually just released this week that basically said that could be as many as a third of Americans who are going to be affected by this don't know where to go.
Well, I know where to go. Actually, I made a phone call today. I called up FCC Commissioner Copps's office just to pursue this question and ask. I had learned that in the United Kingdom, they're doing this right now. They're entering their transition right now, and they're doing what's called a rolling transition, mm-hmm. community by community, and they have local community service agency volunteers going door to door, knocking on people's doors if they can't get them on the phone, and explaining to them your TV, which conceivably could make this a matter of life and death if they have a health concern, if there's a natural disaster in their area and they don't know about it, etc. You can imagine the possibilities when you start thinking about this. Well, they seem to be doing it right there, and this is coming up in a little more than a year in this country, and I asked, I'm waiting for a call back, just to see if it's possible to do that in some way here, to lessen the sudden negative impact of this, the lack of public education on this issue.
In Britain, they're going through a conversion process 4 years long. From 2008 to 2012, they'll be going through this kind of gradual weaning, where by the end of it, everyone who wants a TV in the UK will get a digital television. There won't be any analog TVs anymore. Or if there will be, they won't be able to work with the analog current digital spectrum setup. Here we're going cold turkey. It's basically one day, February 18, 2009. If you have it, great. If you don't, too bad.
Tough.
Yeah. And suddenly a lot of people are going to be left up in the water right now. If you read the essay, go to flowtv.org and look up this website article about the forthcoming DTV tsunami. Or if you go to chicagomediaaction.org, it's listed in the articles there. It basically outlines this entire situation. It's just a big honking disaster, and it's not even a year away, or a little bit more than a year away as we're saying these words.
But it can be turned around, and it can be made into a big positive, as I mentioned, because this transition can be used, once you've educated people about the fact that their TV is going off, you can also use that transition to develop a consensus about reforming public media with all those billions of dollars that will be coming from the return of those old channels.
So, in a nutshell, that's our presentation. Any questions, concerns, comments? What do you have on your mind?
Yeah.
It looks like you've been taking some notes.
Oh, yeah. A little bit. And here's actually the flyer that they have. Oh, you do? Okay. At this point, I personally have a bunch of questions. Mm-hmm. Some deal with the issues that you brought up, but also the organization itself.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'll just go in order. I don't like that one anymore.
We'll look at it later.
Yeah. Okay, actually, this is interesting. Getting to kind of the core relationship that your organization engages with, which is the media. And you talked about this early on in the presentation about the media, who are you going to tell? Who are you going to go to? The media?
Right.
That sort of thing. What is your organization's relationship with talking to Tribune reporters,
mm-hmm.
if they're even going to talk to you, or, that type of thing?
You want
to
go
have,
first?
You I'll go first, first and then
first.
You.
Okay.
We have two approaches, and it's a mixture of the two. That's the only way that it'll work.
Mm-hmm.
One is you have to try to make a couple of really, really good friends within the... I'm not even sure I like this term anymore, mainstream media. I'm hoping that that's like a side stream already, hopefully. But
I like terming it major media.
Corporate media is probably better.
We'll go with that, corporate media. Yeah. I like that, too.
And, yeah, it has that zingy sound to it, doesn't it? But you have to maintain or develop relationships. And when I first started to get involved in this years and years ago, I thought, gee, you know, I could just make friends with all of them and just be, you know, do this like as long as you're friendly and ask the right questions and are respectful to them that, you know, you'll get coverage. But what I learned was just that there's just a few that you'll meet, and the ones that are going to help you, stick with them and develop those relationships, and you can pretty much ignore most of all the other relationships. Mm-hmm. Part B...
My reputation regarding media has been not to dismiss the concerns about cultivating relationships. We've been lucky enough to be able to do just that. But in a lot of respects, I hate to be blunt about this, but in a lot of instances, I feel it's a big waste of time.
Agreed.
Yeah, mainly because you organize press conferences, you release press releases. And
fax blast.
Yeah, they never
phone
come.
Call
they
after
don't
phone
show
call.
Up. Yeah. You send out emails, you send out all these distributions. They don't come, they don't cover it. In a lot of instances, they don't care. And so my approach has basically been the kind of plan B approach. Do everything else you can think of outside of the media. It can mean protests, it can mean handing out flyers, it can mean setting up websites, it can mean contacting every alternative outlet you can think of.
Blogging
a lot. And that's now not inconsiderable. I mean, 5 years ago, nobody knew what a blog is. Now the blogosphere is upwards of 50 million blogs worldwide and growing. In fact, at the rate of almost 6 months by now. Every 6 months, the blogosphere tends to double, in fact. All of these outlets offer opportunities for spreading the word about that. And especially where... This is very intriguing, too. The major corporate media's modus operandi thus far has been don't talk about the media about media-related issues. Like the media ownership issue, net neutrality, I think, are two classic textbook instances of this. And we didn't bother with the corporate media because it would have been a Herculean task to get them to understand. And even if they did, then it would have been a big matter about getting them to get involved on the issue anyway, even if it would have been a matter of running a story about it. And that would have been impossible. We didn't bother with that, or at least I certainly
yet. We also don't have our code, or we don't have law that says that there is such a concept as network neutrality or internet neutrality. So, at some point, eventually, the corporate media is going to have to address this issue, discuss it to some extent, and deal with it because it's there,
right.
And we're not, and other people are not going away.
And there have been a number of high-profile instances of internet discrimination right here in Chicago at Lollapalooza, Pearl Jam. It turns out had talked about, had mentioned some critical words of George W. Bush during a webcast of a concert that they talked about, of a concert that they had talked about, where the. AT&T had basically cut out.
That.
Yeah.
I remember
and
that.
Narrow port pro-choice. A pro-choice group in, a national scale pro-choice group in.
The text.
Yeah, had sent out a text message via cell phones. Verizon blocked that from Verizon customers. This incident actually made the front page of the New York Times. And suddenly now Verizon's on the hot seat, and now suddenly they're forced to be all defensive. Oh, it was an accident. It happened only once. Never again. Comcast, it turns out, has also been caught with their hand in the cookie jar regarding network discrimination. There, the client has been BitTorrent, the program that's used to distribute usually large-scale programs, a lot of instances movies. There, the problem has been that other content that's being distributed via BitTorrent is also getting throttled. Like, for example, copies of the Bible that are distributed via BitTorrent, which you can do, and people do, are also getting blocked out by Comcast. At which point, Comcast is then faced with the rather awkward question Why are you censoring the Bible? And believe me, there is a not inconsiderable, sizable community in this country that would, once word of that spreads, and that's already happening, suddenly now get on Comcast case regarding providing a free and neutral internet for all users in the United States.
And for something like that, even if you don't agree, you know, even if you're not down with the Bible, mm-hmm. in a sense.
Right.
That's interesting because that sort of thing opens up. They can't pick and choose.
No.
In a sense.
That's the idea behind
that's
it. Neutrality.
Idea. Yeah.
It's like you just basically serve as the provider. If someone wants to provide it, they let it through. If someone wants to get it, they can get it.
Well, I mean, the internet is just a series of tubes.
And that remark there, and that actually stems directly from all of this activism. Ted Stevens,
yes,
the Alaska senator, who actually
the corrupt
made...
corrupt Alaska senator.
Very corrupt. He actually made that remark
at
a Senate Commerce Committee hearing, who actually had responded to Olympia Snow, Republican from Maine, who basically brought up the issue regarding having a neutrality provision within the Telecommunications Act as it was moving its way through the Senate in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason that actually became an issue is because groups like CMA and around the country had worked to make it an issue when barely anyone knew its coverage, but wound up making it an issue, getting that kind of arrangement. Ted Stevens was forced to address the issue, and then Ted Stevens basically opened his mouth, and as John Stewart had said, he basically sounded like some drunk guy at an airport at 3 in the morning who doesn't know jack squat about what he's talking about.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's our doing too.
And it's an example of someone who's been involved in telecommunications politics for decades too.
Mm-hmm.
It showed that he knew practically nothing.
Right.
So silly. And kind of going in contrast to corporate media.
Mm-hmm.
What is CMA's relationships with the Chicago-based alternative networks of things like IndyMedia,
mm-hmm.
or you know, other alternative publications.
Have you ever heard of that,
like
Indie Media, Mitchell?
I'm vaguely passing familiarity.
50% of the people in the room are.
So, that
Chicago Media Action was, I counted as founded by a Chicago Indie Media member.
Mm-hmm.
CMA also tries to maintain contacts with as many other independent resources providers in the city that we can name. We were lucky enough to have a fairly good relationship with a lot of people. We also have something of a love-hate relationship with one gentleman named Chuck Mertz. He's the host of a weekly radio show on WNUR Radio out of Northwestern, a show called This Is Hell. I like it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I like the show. It's a very excellent show.
It's a good show,
and,
Chuck.
We do like the show. And,
except when you mention us occasionally.
He mentions us. To his credit, for some reason, we're some kind of a, I don't know,
it's a backhanded advertisement.
Yeah, yeah. He either promotes us or slaps us down, usually at the same time. And there was one particular instance in the summer of 2006 where we had been involved in a kind of side campaign that Democracy Now! Had asked us to get involved, basically to help with helping to get Democracy Now! On the WBEZ public radio in Chicago and an effort to help to get that on talk radio overnight when they were offering that as a proposal and may still do that. So Democracy Now! Had sent us a campaign. We, of course, forwarded it along because we like them and we do good work with them. Chuck Mertz basically took this to an affront, so much so as writing a letter that he would say that he would read on his show, basically accusing CMA of not fostering independent media outlets because, as Chuck termed it, Democracy Now! Is the Walmart of the independent media movement. That there's time, and he's got something of a point. 5 hours of time that could be allotted in the course of a weekly show to other locally responsive shows.
But we know that Chuck is basically a very nice guy and that he really just wants to promote himself and his show, and everyone who has a show wants to do that too. So
yeah,
we're not taking this all too seriously.
I haven't actually seen him since he's made these remarks, but I think it's a matter of...
it's a joke, actually.
Yeah, it's something of a quasi-joke, but also I think of as a matter of, okay,
this
is one thing where we don't see eye to eye. Okay.
So, well, then going with that, the kind of the backhanded promotion kind of remind me of another one.
Mm-hmm.
and which is, and I don't have to ask everything if anybody else wants to jump in. By the by, want to make that clear?
Okay.
What have you found? Is the most effective way to get your views out and things, you know, people knowing not just about your organization, but
mm-hmm.
those things. Is it through principally the website or actions or word of mouth combination?
All of the above.
Yeah.
It's you just take whatever is out there and available to you and develop what you can that's out there and work with it. And you piece it together. And sometimes, miraculously, an action falls into place and maybe succeeds.
Yeah.
Like your Christmas.
That's right.
Like, oh,
in fact, that was just the idea for that emerged the same day that Kevin Martin made the proposal. Maybe a little bit of background. The issue regarding media owner concentration of ownership is raging at the moment we're giving this presentation. Where within about a week's time, current FCC Chair Kevin Martin will, in all likelihood, propose and probably get the votes to amend the cross-ownership rule, which the Tribune has been probably pushing as much as anyone in the country to get repealed.
Thereby stealing Christmas.
Yes. Christmas will be dead because of the Tribune. when Christmas dies, you can thank the Tribune. Thanks, Tribune.
And Kevin Martin.
And Kevin Martin, too. Yeah, Kevin
They're
Martin.
Friends.
Oh, incestuous friends. But anyway, when it was on November 11th when Kevin Martin basically made the proposal, not by circulating it to other FCC commissioners, but basically through an op-ed in the New York Times and a press release. And it's a very interesting way of making policy, to actually try to just say, oh, I'm going to do it this way. And, oh, look, it's such a reasoned, small rule change. Previously, we've been dealing with five big rules. Now it's just one rule. And it's not even the full rule. It's a smaller subset of the 20 major cities.
It's not important.
Cities.
He said it's a minor
Yeah,
thing.
Minor
it's
to
minor
help
thing.
A dying industry.
Don't worry about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, dying so. Industry. 19%, they're from down from 30% to 19% profit interests. And mainly because of not only the internet, but also because a lot of newspapers, through consolidation, have laid off staff, are recycling content, and are basically become, for all intents and purposes, local garbage bins, for all intents and purposes. And suddenly this is a dying industry.
19%.
So therefore we have to grant this regulatory relief. Oh, I need my smelling salts. Oh, my goodness. The same day that that was announced, Chicago Media Action happened to hold a meeting the same day, where we actually decided to take an action, which was a reprisal of an action we had done when former FCC Chair Michael Powell was in town 4 years earlier, and we held a protest and holiday sing-along. We took Christmas carols. It happened to be, when this was happening, it was the week before Christmas mm-hmm. in 2003. We're in Christmas season, so we basically are reprising the action where we took Christmas carols, give them some new media and politics-themed lyrics, and sang them. Mm-hmm. At the time, it was basically outside of the Sheraton Hotel where Michael Powell was giving a talk before the Economic Club of Chicago. Here, it was right outside of the Tribune Tower. The action we held garnered about a dozen people, and about as many police, oddly enough, who were guarding the entrance.
One-on-one, it was a...
Yeah, yeah. So we'd like to right now formally thank the Chicago Police Department for doubling our output of people who participated in this action.
Did any of them sing along?
I don't think so.
No.
We can sing some of these if you want.
Oh my.
Yeah.
Well, let's make this the educational one about the Tribune Company then.
Sam Zell.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, I like that one. I wrote that one. Sam Zell is the billionaire tyrant who is on the cusp of buying the Tribune Company. Mm-hmm. And that actually is also an interesting factor of the very fact that in some sense you could argue that CMA is the reason why Sam Zell's buying the Tribune now. We'll get to that in a moment. Yeah, I'll explain that. It sounds weird. And it's just like, my God, it's $8.2 billion. How can you guys have a say in this? We did. I'll explain in a bit. But Oh Sam Zell, set to the tune of Jingle Bells. Ready?
Stockholders want a change. The Tribune's up for sale. A deal we'll arrange. The check is in the mail. Bribe the FCC. Get our waivers through. Who cares if laws deny our plea? The public has no clue. Oh, Sam Zell, oh, Sam Zell, oh, Sam, how dare you?
Oh, Sam, you can cast a spell if only people knew. Oh, Samzell, oh, Samzell, oh, Sam, how dare you? Oh, Sam, you can cast a spell if only people knew. I think I'll end. Thank you, thank you. Hold the applause. We're here all night. So we sing that in seven other songs.
Oh, absolutely.
We sang that in seven other songs. And, yeah, you know, got radio coverage and some fair amount of internet coverage. And Scott had made a movie. I've also got some additional video footage that we'll be using to probably make a series of movies, hopefully. Yeah. And that's something to also carry that further, so that even more than just the 12 people who had attended or the thousands of people who happened to be passing by on their way to get their Wii or their iPhone. Nonetheless, the resonance of that action can continue. Thanks to a lot of the internet work and also pointing people to other similar actions. What was I going to say?
How about Sam Zell?
Yes.
How'd you guys, what about that?
Yeah. So why is it that Sam Zell, well, remember here this. Here's basically the sequence. September 1st, 2002, Michael Powell, chair of the FCC, announces to practically no fanfare, maybe like two publications in the entire country mentioned this, that he was going to basically revise the media ownership rules. All visitors basically read that to mean he was going to eviscerate them, were the remaining. Five serious rules, and he had everything in place. He had key members of the courts. He had a pro-media Republican Congress. He had a Republican in the White House, and he also had the media, who were basically all on board.
But he put something else in place by making that announcement, CMA. In fact, each of the founders of CMA met because they had heard about that.
That's right.
That's what got us initially together, mm-hmm, was Michael Powell.
Right. Getting that ball
so
going.
So thanks, Mike.
We then made an action in an apartment in Lakeview with about five people in the room to say, okay, we've got to tell people before this happens. Mm-hmm. That could be the key here for doing this. Okay, we're not going to be able to do it through the media. So how do we do it? And the answer is, in any and every way you can possibly think of. We had organized within a month's time a Halloween march through downtown Chicago where we dressed up in costumes. I was dressed as a pirate. And basically went from media outlet to tell people, look, this is coming and this is important, so get involved. We were also on the radio, actually using, here's an interesting tactic, phone calls to area radio stations. If you can tie in something you want
to
talk about.
Call-in shows.
Yeah, to call-in shows. And connect it in with what you want to say to what they're talking about. You'd be amazed how far you get. Oddly enough, I use WGN AM radio. Hey, don't laugh. WGN AM radio, despite the fact that they blew us off during this action last week, mm-hmm, was a big mouthpiece for helping to get the word out. And how? By calling in, and tying it into topics they were already talking about.
And tell them that you really like their show and stuff like that.
Yeah, and publishing it on the internet, certainly. The internet was golden through email contacts, through every... Yeah. Like,
so it was the internet and Michael Powell were two of the bigger factors.
Very big things to help to spread the word about that. And also, oddly enough, you could make this a very strange credit, the war in Iraq.
Yep.
When
third player in this equation,
big
it had
time
to be that war, no question about it.
Here's the role that played in March 2003 when the war, in the run up to the war, you had huge protests around the world. In Chicago and nationwide, you had protests probably of an unprecedented scale, all basically saying, "Don't go to war in Iraq. You're asking for trouble." But we went into war in Iraq anyway, mm-hmm, and it's been trouble since.
Well, CMA found that to be that drive to war, an organizing tool, so to speak.
Yeah.
One of the things that we organized was, meetings that failed, but we attempted meetings with media outlets, particularly WTTW. We got a meeting, we got 30 community group representatives in there, roughly, and made our case. We wanted live public forums. We wanted to talk about this stupid attack and this blatant propaganda that was being spewed over and over and over again through every major media and corporate media outlet, mm-hmm, and they wouldn't give us that space. But we tried. We wanted independent films before that attack. They wouldn't schedule them.
Right.
But again, Michael Powell, the internet, and the Iraq attack.
That key, the media was key there, because if there had been even a fraction of involvement on this issue, and there have been studies that have been done since where the amount of media coverage of this huge anti-war effort in the run-up to a war, which itself is historic, it was practically
invisible.
So then when the war happens, and then when the war becomes a quagmire, suddenly people's... This hits in the craw of a lot of political activists who had tried to stop the war by going out into the streets and writing their representatives and doing everything, even within and
all
outside
the right
of the
things,
law.
All the right things that they were trying
to
do.
And trying to get media coverage and practically invisible where it was there was usually dismissive. So suddenly, when they're told, oh, by the way, look at what Michael Powell's doing at the FCC now. You think things are bad? They're about to get a whole lot worse. And then suddenly, they're brought into the fray.
So if you don't want the pattern to repeat, was our suggestion,
right,
do something about it.
So groups like the National Organization for Women, Move On, Code Pink Women for Peace, groups that a lot of times hadn't been working on media issues, suddenly are bringing into the media issues. And that created that sort of a groundswell. But it wasn't just that. It now extended across to the political right wing, where groups like the Parents Television Council, major right wing group that works on media issues, the National Rifle Association, and other
Christian
groups,
Coalition.
They would join up very key in the net neutrality fight. But all these right wing groups suddenly now entered the fray, where now suddenly it isn't a bunch of left wing kooks. It's a bipartisan issue across the political spectrum.
That proves how much trouble we're in. That right there, those facts, that those type of coalitions that are that broad, should prove to anybody how bad the situation has gotten.
But let's connect this back to Sam Zell and the original question.
Yeah.
So when this happens, this huge groundswell of upwards of 3 million people by the time the dust settles.
Yeah.
Congressional action is taken in the Senate, but not in the House. And actually, thanks to our former guy who just retired, Dennis Hastert. He basically squeezed that possibility of getting that vote in the House because it probably would have passed. When that happens, and a court action in Philadelphia, an emergency court order is filed on the day before the rule is supposed to take place in September 2003, and then suddenly that vote blocks the rule for the time being until a lawsuit is filed the following spring and summer, which winds up winning for our side. The FCC is basically told, you got to start over. You basically stack the deck in your favor, and you have to revisit the matter from the beginning. And you have to do it better this time, and seriously. And suddenly that delayed the issue, especially with the subsequent almost 2 years of appeals, including an appeal to the Supreme Court, all of which failed. Suddenly the investors, where they thought this would have been over and done in 2003, it's now 2006, and in the summer of 2006... investors with the Tribune freak out. They had gambled their future on this trajectory of, we'll eviscerate the media ownership rules, we'll just keep growing, nothing will stop us, and we can continue the profit rates as they are. Now suddenly, the rules aren't there. We can't grow as we expected. Investors panic. They demand an ownership change. Over the course of the subsequent 8 months, they wind up pressing for and getting an ownership change in April. Local billionaire tyrant Sam Zell enters the fray, say, yeah, I'll buy it. Here's $8.2 billion, most of which isn't my money anyway, and I'll buy the Tribune.
Which is the employees' money.
Yeah, a lot of it is employees' money, it turns out.
Unrepresented.
But nonetheless, that fact, so it's like work your way backwards. Tribune is sold off to a local billionaire tyrant because the Tribune doesn't get, because the shareholders freak out. Because they don't get the ownership rule changed, because we blocked them, because the court blocked it, because 3 million people spoke up about the issue, because small groups of people, CMA key among them, spread the issue and made it an issue when no one else even knew. It is no exaggeration to say that we stopped the Tribune in that instance, and Sam Zell could well be the owner.
And in the beginning, we did not have the media at all with us in any serious way.
You have a question?
Yeah. It's almost guaranteed that sometime during the next year that the existing media, the television media, are going to begin preparing a campaign for making in order to make a profit on the digital conversion.
Mm-hmm.
to what extent can CMA anticipate the kinds of pitches and arguments that they're going to put forth and inoculate people against those pitches so that they, you know, essentially neutralize them? Because there's a huge potential profit that they might attempt to make by selling people solutions, expensive solutions, mm-hmm. to the conversion and blaming it on the government.
Mm-hmm.
So what?
Well, we have a pitch that we need to make, and that's to make certain that there will be public interest standards for those digital channels.
At a minimum. But there's also a concern there about, I mentioned it before and I'll mention it again, probably upwards of 50 million people might not even get their TVs working. And now suddenly, oh, they care now. I mean, if there's one thing that you learn about Americans is that you don't screw with their TVs. And now suddenly we are seeing the massive screwing of TVs probably in the history of the United States. All at once. All within the next year of time. Hardly anyone knows about this as happening. I guarantee you, come January and February 2009, there won't be an American alive who won't know about this issue. Mm-hmm. And won't see it as a disaster.
What kinds of positions can CMA put out,
right,
to create a situation when people won't be penalized financially,
that's,
individually, for this conversion?
Some of that is happening now, and I think most of it, at least for the moment, is in the realm of the educational sphere and in getting people. That's going to be one issue. That isn't even eligible yet. Both the FCC and the National Telecommunications Information Agency, the NTIA, the main agency that's in charge of this, are setting up a voucher program so that every household, which is already approved by Congress, I might add, every household in the United States is eligible for two $40 vouchers to help to offset the cost of converter boxes.
Which are maybe $60 or $70.
The first retail of those... Huh?
Maybe, yeah.
They may get lower as technology improves. Yeah, it can be.
There's no question that they can be.
Sure, sure.
They force them to.
The first retail boxes of these sorts actually came on the market over the summer and have a suggested retail price of about $70.
Right, which is too high.
Which is going to be too high for the amount of money as it stands. So then suddenly people are have to get, yeah, yeah, that too. There's a matter there about, okay, how are people going to find out about these vouchers? How do they apply for vouchers? Can the government make sure that they get the vouchers to everyone in time? What are you going to do about the offsetting $30 for people who can't even afford that? And that's probably not insignificant. Are there going to be enough converter boxes for everyone there? It turns out that the retail arrangement among retailers is a voluntary program. They're not being mandated to provide this service.
And right now,
and that could really burn a lot of people in the end.
And
there
right
could
now
be a lot of finger pointing.
There's no requirement yet of the broadcasters to have mandatory PSAs about this.
Yeah.
If you can believe that, that isn't even in place.
They promised upwards, the National Association of Broadcasters, the main trade lobby of the commercial broadcasters, who I like to refer to as the National Association of Bastards, have promised upwards of $700 million worth of public service ads in the run-up to the... This is a promise they've made.
Yeah, priced at their prices.
Priced at their prices, aired on their terms, aired on their times. The first ad I heard about it, one friend of mine told me that he happened to be up at 3:30 in the morning and saw an ad for about the digital television conversion that aired on WGN at 3:30 a.m. So, but I mean, it's like, are you going to like show it like, you know, five times an hour in prime time on every channel you can think of and have like entire shows devoted to this? Chances are no, because that's money that's going to be lost out of this. So oddly enough, the NAB, who you would figure would have the biggest interest in promoting this to the hilt, are probably going to be caught with their head in the sand and unprepared for this deluge themselves. They could be a party of pretty serious concern on this count as well. And it's just all going to materialize within the next year or so on this count on... Nobody knows how, but it could be a disaster. The scale of it is such that, to address your concern, is far bigger than CMA or probably the combined efforts of the media reform movement as a whole. So I think that the way to address this would probably be in the spreading the word about it in the educational realm to encourage every party that be to do a better job of this, whatever
it might
be.
Should be more involved in
it. To use their clout to postpone it.
That would help. The thing, though, is that if you're going to postpone it, you probably have to impose a law to do that, like, now. Because all of 2008, whatever happens, extant broadcasters are going to have to spend 2008 to get ready for the digital conversion when it happens in 2009.
Which was the intent of the law in the
right.
first place, is to force them to move.
Right. Now, you're finding now that even a number of broadcasters are...
So they can't.
They're stuck. And in fact, I saw an article where, like, a number of Fox affiliates of all stations, yeah, poor babies, are now suddenly in this pickle where they're like saying, you know, we've got all this stuff and we're suddenly expected to throw it all out and be digital ready by February 2009, and I don't think we're going to do it. We're not going to have the money. We're going to spend all this time. We're busy making a show now anyway.
And we've only got a 35% profit margin.
Yeah. but I mean, remember that there's power there, but it's also a very fragile kind of power, where even an effort like even as small as like the seven people in this room who are doing their effort on this count to just talk about the issue, the major media are deathly afraid. Remember, it was a group of five people in Lakeview in an apartment there more than 5 years ago that, combined with efforts in Philadelphia, in Seattle, in San Francisco, in other communities large and small across the United States, when no one else would work on this issue, took it up and made it an issue and connected it with other issues to show its salience, bringing more allies into the struggle. Mm-hmm. Wound up winning serious changes, admittedly defensive ones, but considering what would have happened otherwise, I think it's pretty darn good.
Now, in terms of the... you know, what we're trying to do here.
Mm-hmm.
Because the things that we're talking about, we can go on forever and ever and ever and ever, because there's so much. What one of the things in terms of CMA that I was thinking earlier was, because it hits the things that you all go after and fight for and have all these successes, I guess the two things that I want to ask are, in respect to your organization, because it hits every single thing, how do you not get burned out? And, you know, mm-hmm. because it's very daunting and very scary,
yeah.
and but you're still keeping up all this energy. And two, it's not just you two guys. Who else is doing stuff?
You've begun to answer your own question, is that it couldn't possibly be done with two people.
Exactly.
You have to have people you find... what they want to do, what they're willing to do, what they have the time to do, what they're interested in doing.
Yeah.
And put those pieces together. Just like you have to piece together your publicity outlets, you have to piece together people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the effort and energy really comes from, is
yeah.
a lot of people. But with Michael Powell and Iraq Wars and the internet, involved in that mix too.
And Ted
it
Stevens.
Makes it a li- and Ted Stevens. It makes it a little easier to get people upset / involved
mm-hmm.
in stuff
right.
like this, because
yeah.
I think this time around, unlike any time in my lifetime, people are actually concerned about this issue as they might be about the environment or any other
sure.
social
yeah.
issue. It's finally risen to at least a respectable equivalent level.
So
I'll mention one additional factor that I think plays to why CMA is kind of really gung-ho about these issues and keeps going at it, is that I think we had a certain incident regarding our founding that really got a lot of people's fire under their butts to get involved in this issue.
Mm-hmm.
I'm referring to basically the November 2nd, 2002. At the campus at the Crown Center at Loyola University, happened to be the date and time of an event organized by a group called Chicago Media Watch. Admittedly, Chicago Media Action, the group that Scott and I are part of, is a breakaway group from Chicago Media Watch.
But it wasn't a typical schism.
Right. The schism happened precisely because the president of Chicago Media Watch, Leanne Kasten, had unilaterally made a decision at this conference that wasn't announced until the event, until actually it happened. namely that there was a dramatic, sudden, and largely unpopular
panel change.
Where Sut Jolly, who is a longtime professor of communications at the University of Massachusetts and an invited speaker, keynote speaker, and got the only standing ovation of the entire conference, it turns out, wanted to talk about Palestine. And
it's his background.
He had just released a film about this. He had been working on this a lot, and he was correct. It didn't get a whole lot of play as far as major media, so he wanted to talk about it here. He would tie it into issues regarding propaganda and media, of course, because that's what the theme is, that's what the conference is about. But nonetheless, he... with a straight
propaganda
face.
Propaganda was injected into the
situation.
But
nonetheless, Leanne Caston kind of felt that this was just going too far, and so in order to restore some semblance of balance,
that word...
She brought on Richard Baer, who was an educational director for AIPAC. I think it stands for the American-Israel Political Action Committee.
Yes, it does.
It's basically, all right, 10 points. Basically regarded as the major pro-Israel lobby in the United States. They are not people you want to screw around with. Mm-hmm. And their local Midwest educational director was invited to basically give a counter-response.
No warning.
With no advance warning, no advance notice.
For Mr. Jolly.
It was just plopped in there. It's like, okay, we're now doing this.
Sort of, almost a terrorist action,
right.
You could say.
Right.
No,
she's going to an assault.
It
right.
wasn't just Leanne, and she didn't even consult with the other board members of,
mm-hmm.
of MediaWatch.
Right.
It was as a result of pressure from some other people.
Okay.
Friends of theirs.
Okay, but nonetheless...
And it was
yeah.
done without a whole lot of thought.
Sure, but nonetheless, it happened. But that happening... And also the concerns regarding Chicago Media Watch as being a group that should have done a better job in the 10 years before this happened, when it was founded in 1992.
Around a kitchen table in Evanston that I was sitting at.
There you go.
This stuff goes, there's a lot of history here,
right.
folks. There's history before that, too.
Sure. But nonetheless, in 2002, that was the straw that broke the camel's back, especially when I mentioned the Chicago Indie Media founder. A member who had founded CMA, Chris Giovannis, a member of Chicago Indie Media.
Our beloved founder.
I count her as our beloved founder, and I think everyone else does. Basically took to the stage, screaming the whole time, accusing Leanne of being a sellout, of caving in, of every kind of accusation you can think of. And Chris Giovannis, to her credit, was expelled from the building, expelled from the conference, ordered to leave campus, and when she didn't do so in a prompt fashion, placed under arrest. Yep. I talked with 3 days with Michael Miner in the Chicago Reader as he was basically gathering up the threads, and he wrote a very extensive article about this entire affair. You can look it up. He published it in late November 2002 in the Chicago Reader. You can look on their archives. Look up an article with the headline "Man Bites Watchdogs." And that, I think, certainly for me, and I was there when Chris got arrested, I said to myself, I'm never letting this go. I am going to do this work as much as I can and as freely as I can for as long as it takes.
You're not going to watch. You're going to take action.
Someone should name a group like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, at least for me personally.
There is a rich history in Chicago, which we certainly can't go into here. Don't have the time or the details. There's a colorful history of media activism in Chicago. But as I mentioned, this is the first generation or the first this go-around is the first time where the issue is treated more or less as an equal. That it has the same footing.
Well, no, Lucy Parsons raised a pretty big stink. You know, they banned her from speaking in Chicago. So
well, see, these things do go
in
back.
In the middle of the river.
That's true.
And
there
lectured.
You go. But, yeah, that for me is a big motivation for me and why I'm probably going to work on this until my dying breath or until we win, whatever comes first.
Do you have any other questions?
No,
Yeah, but I would encourage people to get involved as well. ChicagoMediaAction.org is a website for us. You can also call us toll-free. The phone number is 1-866-4-MEDIA. 260-7198. We have a toll-free phone number. We'll even pay for the call. If you want to find out more about these issues and get
email
involved,
us, cma@chicagomediaaction.org.
Mm-hmm. And I'll end, I'll send, there are two phrases I always mention whenever I wrap up things like this. One phrase kind of paraphrased by a political analyst and a stand-up comedian by the name of Bob Harris, who in an email years ago wrote, "Democracy is more than what you do in a voting booth on the Tuesday in November. It is what you do with your hands and your heart and your head every day all year long." And another quote that was actually written on a graffiti in Uruguay, but which is, was basically attributed to Eduardo Galeano, the noted Latin American writer, who basically said, "Let's save pessimism for better times."
Well, this was great, guys. And I think that, and especially for people who are going to be watching and listening later, yeah, dude, it's being podcasted. Jeez.
Well, at least we told you that you were being recorded.
Well, there you go.
These days that can happen and you don't even know.
Being cute.
I couldn't have asked personally for a better start to this series. We are many. Inquiries into Chicago activism being held every second Tuesday at the New World Resource Center at 7 p.m. And I think it's great, and I hope to continue this relationship that we've started here, because mm-hmm. it's, you guys are doing great, and I want more people to know about it, because it's
so do we.
Thank you. Thank you for the encouragement.
Yeah,
and
thanks for
words.
Setting this up and organizing. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So I guess we'll close with that, and excellent. So.